Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Beverly Roos-Muller, author of two books published by Jonathan Ball, Bullet in the Heart, Four Brothers Ride to War, and Hunting the Seven, the story of the assassinations of the Guguletu Seven. Thrilled to be talking today with somebody I've known for quite a long time, Professor Gavin Evans from the University of London, who is an author and an academic, has published 10 books, non-fiction books, and he's in South Africa to talk about his latest book, White Supremacy, A Brief History of Hatred. And it is an extraordinary book. I've never seen anything that has such a difficult history compacted into in such an accessible way. I thought it was a really wonderful read and an essential one today. So welcome, Gavin.
Oh, thank you very much, Beverly.
You're talking in this book about white supremacy, which is now prevalent in the world today, raised its head yet again, and its current form, the Great Replacement Theory, which is globalized as we speak. What exactly is the Great Replacement Theory?
Well, it's this idea that it really goes back 150 years to the founding of the eugenics movement in the late 19th century. But in its current form, what it is this, it's an idea of a conspiracy by elites, often George Soros is the person who's put behind it, that white people are being consciously replaced by black and brown people in the United States and by Muslim people in Europe. And that that part of this conspiracy is to dilute the genes of the white population. So that's the essence of the idea. And then what follows from that is that the view that has to be combated, both by breeding programs for more white people, seen as positive eugenics, which Elon Musk is excited about, but more prominently by restricting immigration.
Why is there a notion that white people are supreme to others?
Well, I think that notion really goes back a very long way. It was obviously related to slavery and related to colonialism. And you really see it becoming part of a kind of faux science in the second half of the 19th century. So if you look at Darwin himself, when he wrote the book, The Voyage of the Beagle, his ideas on race were a bit ambiguous. He was anti-slavery and so on and so on. But by the time we get to The Descent of Man, which is one of his last his last big book, later in his life, the level of racism is profound, even for his own time. So these ideas became part of the kind of currency of the 19th century, and they've lingered, and they keep on popping up again. This idea that people are defined by their racial birth in terms of their character, in terms of their intelligence, and in terms of their abilities, and that these things are innate. Recent version of it is the idea that Ashkenazi Jewish people are innately more intelligent than others. People like Steven Pinker have promoted that idea. And it's wrong, and they don't understand the science of it. And it's very easy to show why that idea is wrong, but it's the cat's paw, because if you say one group is less intelligent, more intelligent, you're saying implicitly that others are less intelligent. So that's the kind of mainstream version of race science, which has played into this idea that there are people who are born more intelligent, and they need to be protected. Their genes need to be protected from being muddied by those of others, which is why you've got to keep immigrants out and promote the birth of white people. And that's the idea underlying it.
You are actively involved in the Royal Institute's Challenging Pseudoscience group. Now, one of the problems that we have today is that in the internet particularly, and we'll get to the alt-right in a moment, it's easy to disseminate ideas that are false. Mm. And as a matter of fact, many books and theories over the years, even recent years that I can remember, have been based on completely false science. Mm. But the problem is that once this myth gets out, like the whole false story of vaccines cause autism, once it's out there, it's very difficult to touch it and bring it back in again. Mm. How do you challenge that?
Well, okay, so I mean, on that one, it's very interesting. Just to divert there, the idea that the MMR vaccine caused autism, many people believed this because it was being promoted very vigorously on the emerging web. And people who went in for that became anti-vax as soon as COVID came, went down a rabbit hole, many of them. So you got someone like Naomi Wolf, who was a feminist writer, who advised two presidents of the United States, who was a prominent liberal. She goes down this conspiratorial rabbit hole and comes out of it a full-on alt-righter who's on the podcasts of Steve Bannon, poses abortion legalization, and so on. That's happened with quite a few people. It's the idea that there's a conspiracy out there relating to vaccines can lead to much more, even more dangerous territory. Now, how to combat it, you've got to push out constantly, explain why this is wrong, be in the media, contradict claims that are made on online sites. And one's not always winning, but I think one has to make the effort because you do need to challenge these ideas.
And publish a book like White Supremacy, which is a pushback against, in a very, very easy to read form, about exactly how and why they're wrong. I was actually quite shocked to read some of the things about people that people like Churchill had said. Hmm. I had not realized. A lot of people don't understand what alt-right is. If you could explain that and who exactly is getting into that.
Yeah, the alt-right's a kind of convenient term. It just means the alternative right. And the alternative is that the previous right were kind of skinhead Nazis who marched around and beat people up. Well, that still happens. But the alt-right were web-based. And a lot of them were based on message board sites. Probably the most prominent of those is one called 4chan. So I, as part of the research of this book, went into 4chan and actually my wife Margie said, you've actually got to spend some time there. I would spend like every day an hour on the worst part of 4chan, which is their poll tab. And the material there was so vile, the level of misogyny, the level of neo-Nazi and actually just straight Nazi hatred, the level of white supremacist ideas and the language that was used, that I needed a rest after a week. It was just getting too much. So that's where this stuff brews. And the terrible thing is that lots of young men are attracted to these sites. They like doing the trolling. They like to trigger people they don't like. They like to own the libs, as they call it, own the liberals. And so they go from 4chan and then go and troll on more mainstream sites like Twitter, like Facebook, and so on. So that's what's meant by the alt-right.
The problem with this is that although some of them may be a little mentally disturbed and although some of them might, you know, sit in a room and never have any social life, some of them actually do go out and perform mass shootings. Mm. And one of the things that you do in the book, White Supremacy, is you do give time to some of the victims. You start off with a very specific one. And you have an absolutely terrifying chapter in terms of grief called, you know, 8 killers, 202 bodies of men who fit this exact scenario, who have actually access to guns. And that's the thing. You need a number of things to happen. And then you also need access to guns too. And if you could speak to that.
Yeah, that's such a huge thing. I mean, the reason I started each of those with the victims was I just felt because I went deeply into these cases and I see so much attention is given to the killers and none to the victims. Or very little to the victims. So in each case, I chose one of the victims and told his or her story. And I thought it was necessary to do that before getting on to the killers. And you're quite right. I mean, I was looking for ones all over the world. So I've got the New Zealand killer who came from Australia, the Anders Breivik who killed people in Norway. I was looking for one in Britain. And the only one I could find was Thomas Meyer, who was a big, big fan of apartheid South Africa. He killed a Labour Party MP and he got a stolen gun. He managed to get a stolen shotgun. And that's how he got a gun. But he only killed one person. When you've got semi-automatic rifles, you can kill lots of people. So the first case I've got is a young man who was 19 at the time called Peyton Gendron. In upstate New York, he gunned down and killed 10 black people at a supermarket. And he was someone who had been radicalized on 4chan, taken the ideas of white supremacy, including from some of these more mainstream advocates of race science that he cited in his manifesto.
Now, you mentioned South Africa. You were an activist during the apartheid years, and I think last time I saw you, you were in Lusaka.
Yeah.
back in the day. I want to just naturally talk about the issue of farm murders and the what's going on at the moment about with some whites, a few Afrikaners, by no means the majority, who are claiming, you know, that they are under threat. Can you talk to that?
Yes. So it's become South Africa's become a kind of cause célèbre of the alt-right internationally. In fact, three of the mass killers that I focus on in the book wrote extensively about South Africa and their support for apartheid. In the case of Anders Breivik, he had a whole chapter on South Africa, citing various South African bloggers who were claiming kind of white genocide, that idea. So it's become Tucker Carlson, who's a big supporter of Trump, had a huge followership following on Fox until he was fired from there. He's been someone who's not only pushed the whole great replacement idea, but has pushed the South African issue. So it's become a big issue internationally. It's convenient for the international outright because it seems to aid their cause. But as to what they're talking about, it really is nonsense. And I looked at all the research on this. I mean, every farm murder is terrible, but the number of farm murders has declined. So over the last 15 years, there's been a decline year by year in the number of farm murders. And those are not killed by people who've got a political grievance. They are by criminals who have access to guns. So it's terrible. The farm murders are terrible, but it's not white genocide. Whites are actually much less likely to be murdered than any other population group in South Africa. And there's not been mass expropriation, which is the other thing, of land. I mean, I think still the figures of land distribution are whites own something like 70% of the land. So, you know, if anything, the land division doesn't aid the kind of idea of a genocide of white people or white farmers. And they've been compensated at market rate. So there's no truth to it, but it's a convenient myth. It's because it aids the cause of, I guess, people like Kali Creel and others, but it also aids what people like Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump and Elon Musk are saying.
In fact, I looked at the latest statistics. The last quarter, the end of last year, the last 3 months into this year, and there were 12 farm murders in South Africa, one of which was a white person. Now, one is too many, obviously, but those are the real statistics. And that's why I want to come back to you're part of a group that challenges pseudoscience. I mean, how do you try and stop this barrage of rubbish and false news, the actual fake news as opposed to what Trump calls fake news? How do you combat it? It seems an impossible task.
If you say it's impossible, then you're going to get to a point where you say, "Oh, what's the point of doing anything?" And I do think that writing, publishing, talking about it on podcasts, putting it on social media, getting to where the people who are absorbing this kind of thing are based. I mean, going into schools. I think it's all very important just to challenge these ideas, to challenge white supremacist ideas, to challenge great replacement ideas, to challenge the misogyny that so often goes hand in glove with white, with this kind of extreme race stuff as well.
I think that one of the things that I want to interject at this point is that there is a part in your book where you do say that there is good news in that the examples of, you know, the spread of racial hatred is in fact dropping. And particularly, I think, as the people get younger, you know, there's less and less pushback against mixed marriages and gay people and, you know, et cetera. What is a little frightening is that in this hate, white supremacy hatred of black and brown and Jewish people and Muslims, et cetera, you know, there's also a pushback against women. If some groups say women shouldn't have the vote. And you know, for me, coming out of a activist background of, you know, fighting for women's the right of choice and so on, this is actually quite terrifying. But I want to really go back to the idea of white supremacy and the effect it's had on the whole discourse around immigration, which has, you know, just taken over not just North America, the United States, but also Europe as well. I mean, you know, Donald Trump is saying, you know, they're eating the cats and the dogs, and we all fell over laughing. But actually, it was a terrifying example of what people are prepared to believe.
Yeah, so I think immigration is what's driving a lot of it. The view that by people coming into the country who are not part of that culture, let's take the most generous version of it rather than the racist version, they need to be stopped, that we're being swamped. And in Europe, it's mainly focused on Muslims. In America, it's mainly focused on Hispanic people, but also on black people. And this idea of replacement, this idea that the genetic stock is being muddied, comes into that. The reality of immigration, is that the entire West and also Southeast Asia really need it, because the birth rate, to replace the population, just to keep an even level population, needs to be 2.1 per woman. I mean, I don't know how someone can have 0.1 of a child, but you know what I mean. So 2.1 per woman. Now, throughout, none of the countries in Europe are even close to two. Even those who've gone to great efforts to encourage women to have more birth, like Hungary, right? A right-wing country, which has said, "Look, we need to have native Hungarians being born," that made only a minuscule difference. It's even worse in places like South Korea and Japan, where they're below one. So they're not replacing their population. And the obvious answer is immigration, but immigration goes against these kind of nativist fantasies that people have, and the result is going to be a catastrophe, because you're going to have fewer people working and more old people who are going to need to get pensions and so on. And the economy might not be able to take that strain. So they're creating a kind of long-term, not even very long-term, a medium-term problem for themselves by shutting off borders at a time when not enough people are being born.
In fact, I saw something today in which Cuba very pertly pointed out to the United States that if, you know, they wanted to introduce tariffs and whatever, if they didn't have Cuban doctors, the United States health system is going to have a really hard time working. Okay. So, you know, people are beginning to push back. And I think that Elon's trying to repopulate the planet entirely on his own, which is an equally terrifying thought at the moment, given the number of children he seems determined to have.
12 so far.
No, it's 14.
14? You or me. Another two since another,
excuse me, he's moving. In your book, you say that these sort of disgruntled, disaffected white men who sit in rooms and read the alt-right, you know, there are certain things that need to be in place for them then to enact these tragedies, the mass killings. You point out that, you know, a lot of it blame is put in by the conservatives, saying, oh, well, they're mentally disturbed. Well, and you quite rightly point out that millions of people are mentally disturbed and they don't pick up a gun and go out and, you know, kill as many people as they can find. So there's certain factors that need to be in place for this to be able to happen. And you mentioned the, you know, the, that after the tragedies that you talk about in your book, in places like New Zealand, Australia, England, so on, that gun, stronger gun laws are brought in. But in the United States, that's not a possibility.
Well, the United States, I mean, it's a bizarre interpretation of a constitutional amendment that, that gives militias rights to arm themselves, and that is interpreted that everybody should be able to buy an AK-47 and do what they want. So it is bizarre, but the National Rifle Association has immense power, and people don't want to oppose that. So I think, as you said, the three things that are crucial in terms of producing these killers. I mean, the one I think. If you're going to be going out and killing lots of people, you're going to have a few things wrong in your brain, or your mind anyway. The second is that you've got to find places where this hate develops, places like 4chan, which is still on the clear net. And the third thing is you've got to have a way of putting that into practice, and that means being able to buy guns without any restrictions. And all of those exist in the United States. So in other countries, first of all, Australia had a mass killing and they cracked down on gun ownership. Now New Zealand have done the same thing. Britain had a mass killing in a school and they basically banned handguns. You can, if you're a farmer, you can have a shotgun, that's it. But the United States hasn't and is unlikely to, for a very long time at least, to do that. So I think, I mean, it's likely that these killings will continue.
You know, some years ago, I spoke to the author Lionel Shriver about a wonderful book, We Need to Talk About Kevin, which was a mass killing in a school. And I said something to her that she hadn't known, which is South Africa is a country with which millions of unlicensed weapons, and yet we've never had one.
Yeah, when I was looking to see whether there were any kind of outright mass murderers, there were a few, like about about 2001, somewhere around there. But it's been despite all the rhetoric, that hasn't happened, which is interesting. And it says something about the country. I'm just not exactly sure what it says, but that there's availability of guns, there are people with crazy ideas, and yet they're not going on mass shootings like they do in the United States and some other parts of the world which I focused on.
Well, and I think also you have to have a kind of a particular ideology, like white supremacy, or an alternative to that, you know, something else, where, you know, which, and people spurring you on to say, you know, to encourage you to basically go out and do that. I mean, everything that is being said by the alt-right at the moment really stokes that fire. And in a way is a taunt, you know, what to young people who follow them, you know, what are you going to do about this catastrophe of immigration and all these people who shouldn't, this idea, the notion, and all of them are from immigrants themselves, but that doesn't seem to filter in.
It's particularly with young men. I mean, these message board sites are overwhelmingly populated by young men. And I mean, if we look, for example, at the recent German elections, the far-right party, a lot of support from young men, but not much from young women. The left-wing party had a lot of support from young women, but not much from young men. A similar thing could be seen with voting for Trump, where far fewer young women proportionately voted for Trump than young men. So there's this kind of gap. And what I thought with the young men, at least in the United States, there's the sense that they have of that they've been disempowered and they're used to dominating and they're used to being the king of the household because their fathers were and their grandfathers were. And they no longer have that position and can't take that. And I think some of that it's driving some of that resentment that channels them into platforms like 4chan. And some of them end up the ones who buy rifles and kill people.
Is that what we should be most worried about? What do you think we should be most worried about by the rise of this movement?
I think there are a lot of things to be worried about. I think that the mainstreaming of a version of race science is very worrying, because it gives a legitimacy for other forms of race science. People might think, oh, well, everybody knows Jews are smart. But actually, the evidence of that is that before the Second World War, the average Ashkenazi Jewish IQs in America were below average. So it's simply a cultural thing. And it's related to abstraction and being exposed to abstraction that IQ scores are about. But so this idea that one group is innately more intelligent really does drive the idea that other groups are less intelligent. And I think that's becoming more and more mainstream, and that worries me. So there's that, and then the young men and places like 4chan. And those are the things that I think really need to be challenged.
And I'm also really concerned about the language that is used. You know, the language that Donald Trump uses is about immigrants being barbarians and rapists and killers and so. You know, amping up that kind of language, is that trying to send a message about this out there?
Well, I mean, I'm never quite sure that with Donald Trump whether he has a coherent message or just a range of desires and gut instincts. And with Trump, I always feel he's so solipsistic that everything concerns himself. He probably has deep racial prejudices, and these come out in his rhetoric, which is kind of whatever pops out of his mouth. But it seems to animate his base, and so more and more pops out of his mouth because it seems to serve his interests doing this kind of thing. I mean, Trump's a hard one to pin down.
And also being South African, you know, Elon Musk has been a bit of a thorn in our flesh. I remember saying to somebody, America, please keep him. We don't want him back. But he does, the power that he has at the moment in terms of, moving these kind of debates is being the richest man in the world. I mean, he could buy a whole country. That's also pretty terrifying.
Yeah, he has immense power. But also, the fact that Mark Zuckerberg has bent the knee to Trump, and others, of the sort of technical side of the computer world, people like Peter Thiel, who actually grew up in Swakopmund, in the apartheid days when, it was heavily populated by Nazis and former Nazis. So there is this link. But I mean, on the other hand, there are lots of South Africans who are living in different countries who take the opposite view. So I don't think we can put too much on their origins. But yeah, I mean, people like Elon Musk, immense power at the moment, and someone who's a person who's deeply damaged, I think, by his childhood, and deeply immature as well, but has immense power.
I thank you, Gavin. It's been fascinating talking to you as always. And by the way, I remember your boxing book, Boxing Dancing Cheese That's Dead, one of my favorite ever. You know, as we all puzzle at events happening right now in 2025, when we ask the questions, though, how did we get here? Why is this suddenly happening? And so on. After all, are the world's civil and human rights struggles, it seems that we're going sort of backwards, but, you know, there seems to be some indication that, in fact, there's hope. Your explanation is clearly and masterfully laid out in an easily digestible form in this profoundly important, quite short book, easy to read. For anyone who wants to understand the long road of how we got here and where it might go, I cannot recommend White Supremacy by Gavin Evans highly enough. It is published by Jonathan Ball. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Beverly.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.